The views and opinions expressed on this show are not intended to provide healthcare advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of Hay House Radio or its staff.
It's your turn now. Learn how to flourish with Dr. Christian Northrup.
Good morning, everyone. I am very excited about today's show, which is the cure for sugar addiction, which many of you have, and I have had myself. Before we get there, let me tell you about my latest blog. Perhaps you've heard or even used the colloquial phrase, what a shame, or shame on you. But have you ever thought about what shame actually is and how it could be affecting your body, your health, your life by limiting your sense of self? We have evidence that feeling ashamed of yourself actually produces inflammatory chemicals called IL-6 in the body. In my latest blog, I tell you how to release unjustified shame so that you can live heaven on earth. So go to drnorthrup.com. And frankly, the topic of shame very much relates to today's show. My guest is Dr. David Ludwig of Boston Children's Hospital. He's an MD, PhD, practicing endocrinologist, researcher at Boston Children's Hospital, and for years, I have been a fan of Dr. Ludwig's work, and he understood the problem with sugar and insulin long before we understood that the sugar industry and Coca-Cola and all of these people were paying researchers to vilify fat, not sugar. So we now know that this has been a rather concerted effort to make you not look at the real culprit and instead vilify fat. And Dr. Ludwig is the founder of the Optimal Weight for Life Children program at Children's Hospital called OWL, which I love. I imagine maybe they have owls around in the with the little chairs and so on. Anyway, he has conducted many original studies linking sugar-sweetened beverages and fast food to obesity. Time magazine described him as an obesity warrior. He's fought for fundamental policy changes to improve the food environment, which I just talked to David, and he said he sees his job as Daniel in the lion's den. His book, Always Hungry, Conquer Cravings, Retrain Your Fat Cells, and Lose Weight Permanently, is a phenomenal, phenomenal book. It's based on research and all of these people who've been shamed about their inability to lose weight, are finally doing it with the help of this book. To learn more about David's work, go to drdavidludwig.com. Dr. David Ludwig, LUDWIG.com. David's also married to a Whole Foods chef who used to be a macrobiotic chef. And so we have that history together. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Chris. So great to be with you, and congratulations on your pioneering work connecting food, our emotions, and health, which you've been a beacon of wisdom there for many years for many of us.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I listened to you. There's a couple things that I want to ask you before we get to our callers. And one is, I've recently been listening to Jason Fong's podcast. As you probably know, and you probably know Jason, he is a nephrologist in Toronto who treats end-stage kidney disease with dialysis and so on. And he realizes and is very vocal about the fact that the practice of medicine really does not understand the way kidney disease, that kind of end-stage kidney disease, doesn't happen overnight. It's something that usually takes 20 to 30 years to develop, and it's very associated with type 2 diabetes, which you now are seeing in 8-year-olds. So if you think about the burden of this for society, it's huge, but for us individually. Now, Jason is recommending therapeutic fasting. And so what I want to get out of the way right away, I've always been under the impression that fasting lowers the metabolic rate and also leads to the loss of muscle. Dr. Fung said this is not true at all. He cites studies that show that fasting increases the metabolic rate by 13% and does not cause the losing of muscle whatsoever. Can you talk to that?
Well, sure. You know, and Jason's doing some very interesting work, and he himself has a book on fasting just out. I consider fasting really a two-edged sword. It's a very powerful technique if done the right way, but very often it's done the wrong way. And, you know, people intuitively understand that if they just stop eating for a day, they get very hungry. It's exceedingly difficult for many people to fast, even 12 hours. I mean, to go, without having a bedtime snack and then having some, unfortunately, something oftentimes sugary and processed carbs in the morning. But the key to understanding fasting is the metabolic state that we're in when we begin the fast. For most people who are eating a carbohydrate-heavy diet that's generally low in quality, insulin levels are high in the body, and I call insulin the miracle grow for your fat cells. Not the miracle you want happening in your body. And so what that insulin does is program your fat cells to store calories, to hold on, and it inhibits those fat cells from releasing calories back into the body as effectively as needed when we stop eating. And that's why, people get hungry again 2 or 3 hours after a meal. They're hungry. That's the title of my book, Always Hungry?
Yeah.
And so how do we expect people to fast when their body is in that metabolic state? So in our program, we have a three-phase program. The first phase is 3 meals and 2 snacks a day. We tell people to eat as much as they want until satisfied and snack whenever they're hungry, because we need to turn off the starvation response. If you just stop, if you just try to cut back calories or the ultimate calorie reduction, which is fasting, and your body isn't metabolically prepared for it, you go into a starvation response. And what is that? It's commonly experienced, rising hunger. Yes, metabolic rate will slow down in that state if you enter fasting that way. And your body secretes stress hormones like cortisol, which work to drag calories out of storage, but the wrong calories. You don't want calories coming out of your muscle and your lean tissue. You want them coming out of fat cells. So how do we do this? Fasting can be very effective if we're fat adapted. And that means that our fat cells have been trained a bit to release their calories on demand.
Got it.
The best way to do that is by first not starting fasting, but first improve the quality of what we eat, cut down on the processed carbs, eat a lot of healthy fats, the right amount of protein. Insulin levels drop, and then the fat cells become adapted. So you can move from feeding to fasting in a much more, in a much less stressful way. And in that state, intermittent fasting can help some people, take good results, to the next level.
That makes so much sense when you think about where the vast majority of people are. You're right. Just going into a fast would be very, very stressful. Your program is, there's a kind of induction phase. So the first 2 weeks, it's no added sweeteners of any kind. I did this, everybody, and I worked with Dr. Ludwig's wife, Dawn, and I was wondering about stevia, which I use in iced tea and in coffee. And they said, for 2 weeks, don't do that, because you want to reset your taste buds. And sometimes just the taste of sweet, even if it's a healthy sweet like stevia, low calorie, no calorie, but still a sweet taste, might trigger an insulin response. Do you want to talk to that a little bit?
Sure. We know that there are sweetness receptors, not just in the mouth. Those aren't just... those sweet taste buds aren't just in the mouth, but there are sweet receptors, the very same ones, both throughout the gastrointestinal tract and also on fat cells.
Wow.
And so some of the artificial sweeteners that we consume, you know, will be stimulating not just that experience of sweetness in the mouth, but will be stimulating receptors elsewhere in the body that could have metabolic effects. Those effects could include raising insulin, you know, that granddaddy of all fat storage hormones. And if they're stimulating fat cells, I mean, that's you know, preliminary studies suggest you can get concentrations of some of these artificial sweeteners, like if you're drinking 3-4 diet colas a day, you could get concentrations in your bloodstream that will activate those taste buds on fat cells. And if those get activated, you're doing exactly the opposite thing of what you want to do to lose weight. Now, yes, if you're drinking 3 or 4 sugary beverages and you switch to artificially sweetened beverages, you're going to do your body a favor. But that's not necessarily the full question. It's what happens with those artificial sweeteners compared to unsweetened or just natural kinds of beverages. Do you take one step but also limit the results that you can get, both for metabolic reasons that we just discussed, but also because you're continuing to program your neurobiology, that connection between your mouth and your brain and your behavior, to crave these hyper-sweetened foods and inhibiting ability to appreciate the natural sweetness of fruits and other foods that may not be sweet at all.
Right. I remember when I began to add back, actually, it didn't take me very long. So during this 2 weeks, what I found is that suddenly an apple or berries with no sweetener whatsoever were exceedingly sweet. So I would ask everyone who's listening who wants to improve their metabolic rate, just remove all added sweeteners of any kind for 2 weeks, and you will indeed not only reset your taste buds, but as you're telling us, reset the gut sweet receptors and the taste buds on fat.
I mean, that's like... Right. So this is the key. A fundamental concept of my book, Always Hungry, is that our body rebels against deprivation. If you just cut back calories, your body's going to fight back. You'll lose a few pounds. Of course, that's just the law of physics. But, you know, humans are not inanimate objects. Calorie balance, calorie in and out concept works well if you're a toaster oven. But, you know, humans are dynamic biological systems. And when we cut back calories, or if you just remove sugar, either biologically or psychologically, you're going to feel a sense of deprivation. So you have to replace it with something. And the key is to help you get rid of not just sugar, but the whole range of processed carbs that flooded our diet during the low-fat years. Bread, rice, potato products, cookies, low-fat chips, crackers, the fat-free Twinkie, you know, the ultimate example, or the snack well phenomenon. To get rid of those, we've got to increase the fat in our diet. And many of these fats, as every cook knows, are luscious, tasty. Olive oil, avocado, nuts and nut butters, rich sauces and spreads, full-fat dairy, even real dark chocolate. So we allow some of these really healthful fats back, and we can talk later about how they're not just good for our waist, they're great for the heart. You let some of these fats that were banished from our plate with the first food guide pyramid back into the diet, and they help you get rid of these processed carbohydrates without missing them, so you don't have to suffer deprivation. Last thing I wanted to say about this is, you know, we think of obesity as a state of excess, you know, too much. You know, so just eat less, force yourself to move more. That creates more deprivation. In fact, obesity is really a state of starvation. The fat cells are on calorie storage overdrive. They're feasting. But the rest of the body is actually starving. There aren't enough calories to feed the brain consistently, to feed the liver and the muscles and the kidney, as you described earlier. And so that's why we get hungry. And that's why metabolism crashes on a low-calorie diet. we have to treat the source of the problem. Just cutting back calories or fasting, if we're not prepared for it, is symptomatic treatment. The source of the problem is these fat cells on calorie storage overdrive, mostly by insulin, but other factors in our life, sleep deprivation, stress, and other things. And once we treat that, these fat cells open up, the calories flood back into the body, and you don't have to force deprivation on. You can allow your body to shed those extra pounds without worsening the problem by adding deprivation to a system that's already in starvation.
One of the things that you have pointed out, which I want everyone to hear, is that this thing that we've all been told and that many healthcare practitioners are still telling people, decrease your calories, increase your activity. This results, it's just wrong. Then, of course, we blame the person for regaining the weight. And it also creates a broken metabolism. And it seems that every time you do this, and I'm looking at my own life, so I've been doing this since I was 12, your metabolic rate decreases. Can you talk about that and how to fix the broken metabolism?
Right. Well, you just said it really well, Chris. The calorie in, calorie out model that considers all calories alike says that, it's just ultimately a question of willpower. So eat less, move more, you'll lose weight, that'll take care of the problem. And so many people struggling with their weight have heard their doctors, nutritionists, and really, others, well-meaning people, friends, family, suggest that. Just eat less, move more, and you'll take care of the problem. So here's the problem with that. As you said, first, it doesn't work. Very few, less than 10% of the U.S. population who are excessively heavy have ever lost just 10% of their body weight for just 1 year. Now, that's based on self-report. It's a national survey, and it's probably overestimated because people are typically a little optimistic about their accomplishments. Just 10% of their excess weight, of their body weight, isn't even much of the problem for many people who have significant obesity. So we have to recognize that the current approach has failed. It's a miserable failure. It's worse than the treatment. The success rate of obesity treatment is worse than the treatment of almost every cancer. And ironically, we typically blame people for that failure. We said,
that's the thing. We shame them.
Yeah, if you're not succeeding, it must be your fault. You just have to try harder.
Right.
Eat even less and move even more. But we're not considering the possibility that the advice we've given people, that the basic all calories are alike paradigm, is actually the problem. And instead, we're just blaming people for that failure. The purpose of my book, Always Hungry, is to look at this new science of weight control without hunger. It turns the calorie balance equation on its head.
It really does. And everybody
is, eating doesn't make you fat. Overeating doesn't make you fat, not over the long term. It's the process of getting fat that makes you overeat. And we have to address that, the hormonal drives of weight gain. Let me just give you a metaphor. Let's think about fever. Back 100 years ago when people didn't understand the physiology of fever, just like many people don't, science doesn't necessarily understand the biology of body weight control. So 100 years ago, you went to your doctor with a fever. Maybe you had a bad cold or something. And your doctor said, I'm not sure what's going on, but it's really just a problem of heat balance, rather than calorie balance, heat balance. Too much heat in the body and not enough heat out of the body. So from a physics perspective, that's correct. So he said, your doctor said, just get into an ice bath and you'll remove heat from your body and you'll break the fever. And of course that would work, right? If you got into an ice bath, you'd suck heat out of your body and your temperature would go down. But what's going to happen? Your body is going to fight back severely, intense shivering, blood vessel constriction. and you're going to have an overwhelming desire to get out of that ice bath as soon as possible. So we understand that that is a primitive approach to treating fever. If you if you address the underlying biology, that give aspirin or treat the source of an infection, then you lower the body temperature set point, and your body releases that extra heat without any struggle. You know, after the aspirin, you start sweating, you throw off your clothes, your body temperature declines naturally. And the same thing is true in obesity. If you treat the underlying problem, these fat cells and calorie storage overdrive, your body naturally wants to get rid of those excess calories. Your body weight set point declines, and you lose weight with your body's cooperation, not with your body kicking and screaming.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, and by the way, everyone, the book, Always Hungry, has a phenomenal program, beautiful recipes, easy to do. And I think that it's a wonderful contribution to where people actually are. So I really, truly appreciate your approach, because Jason talks about the fasting, but when your approach to that is far more gradual and I think easier on the body over time. I'd like to take some calls here. We've got some good ones. So Linda in Toronto, she has a question about sugars and weight loss. How to figure out which foods turn into fat in the body and which to avoid. So Linda, just tell us your question in your own words.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I find it very interesting because exactly what you've been saying for starving the body. I've always been a professional dieter for years. And my question is, like, I'm not a big sugar eater, so I'm just wondering what the hidden sugars in food, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because I can't, you know, especially after turning 50, I haven't been able to. I've been gaining 10 to 15 pounds a year, you know, and I don't know what to do anymore. And I think maybe I am starving my body. I'm not sure.
Sure. Well, hello from Toronto. We're going to be up there, Dawn and I, at George Brown College. I don't know if you know them. They're the main culinary institute. We're going to be up there Friday and Saturday, November 11th and 12th. And I think there's a public session. I'll be lecturing. Dawn will be doing cooking demonstrations. So check us out. Come visit. And so in terms of sugar, we need to be thinking in a broader context. You know, fruit, whole fruits, the main source of calories is sugar. And it's very much the same types of sugars, mostly, as in table sugar, which is sucrose, so that's a combination of glucose and fructose. But fruit is consistently associated with improved health for virtually everybody, except in the cases of really severe metabolic problems, like, you know, poorly controlled type 2 diabetes. There may be a compelling reason to go very, very low in total carbohydrate. But for most of the population, fruit, whole fruits, and I'm talking about the temperate fruits, not so much the tropical fruits like banana and melons, but the temperate fruits like berries, apples, and so forth, you know, are very healthful. But they have sugar. So what's the difference between that and table sugar? Well, the key is how fast it's digested and absorbed and enters the body. When we eat processed sugar, added sugar, or for that matter, almost any processed carbohydrate, and that includes white bread, white rice, potato products, you know, the low-fat cookies, crackers, and the like, these are digested into sugar. All carbohydrates turn into sugar, but the processed ones turn into sugar very quickly in the body. The fructose slams into the liver. The glucose raises your insulin levels, and that takes a direct hit on your fat cells. I personally don't think that fructose is, you know, the entire problem, and glucose, you know, gets a pass. I think they're both, you kind of choose your poison there.
Okay, so that's important.
as we cut back on added sugars, the obvious ones, yes, there's also a lot of added sugar in food, so it's processed food. So ideally, we'll be eating less processed food, but if you eat it, read the label. But at the same time, we don't want to just eliminate the added sugar and eat more bread. That's not the trade-off we want. We want to cut back on all of these processed carbs, increase the healthy fats. That's the easiest and most delicious way to do it. And unprocessed carbohydrates are fine, like whole fruits, beans, and for many people, you know, some minimally processed grains.
Okay. Linda, okay. Does that answer the question? I would get the book, Always Hungry, because I think that it's got the answers. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Ludwig, what is your take on nighttime eating? I know that many, many people whose bodies are overweight but who are starving begin their evening meal at 5 and end it at about midnight.
Yeah, right.
You talk
that's
about
a really common and unhealthy pattern, you know, so people eat tremendous amounts in the evening and at night, and then they wake up kind of sick to their stomach and don't want to eat until later in the day, when at that point the body's back in starvation mode and you overeat again and propagate this vicious cycle. Now that dissociates, sort of separates when the food is going into the body from when the food is when the calories are actually being used. So we want to get that match as accurate as possible. And ultimately, having a reasonably sized breakfast, lunch, dinner, depending on how physically active you are, perhaps a snack or two is okay. But to make that transition, I don't have people just stop eating at night. The first thing to do is to begin to, again, consistently.
You're a kind man.
Deprivation. What?
I said, you're a very kind man.
No deprivation. Listen, you know, there's too much deprivation already, you know.
It's so true, yeah.
And you've got, you know, to change our behavior takes effort. You don't want to be creating a battle between biology and behavior. That's not a battle we're going to win. So you have to be kind to yourself, but that lets you be disciplined. So we first start by having a little tiny breakfast. Most people, even if they've binged the night before, they can have just like a piece of whole fruit. You know, that's easy enough. So you just have a little tiny breakfast, and then you eat a little less that night. And then the next morning, you have a little bigger breakfast, maybe a little tiny lunch, and then eat a little less, progressively less, until you've shifted over a week or two to a more natural distribution of food. And then, you know, again, we increase the fat, we try to retrain those fat cells. And then eventually, if you want to get into intermittent fasting, you know, that's an option, although I don't think it's necessary, but it can be an option for some people.
Okay, that's beautiful, beautiful. Now, we did have a call, and I want to address this because we're seeing so much of it, and it was a person who called and said she's been diagnosed with a fatty liver, so she's worried about eating more fat.
Okay, well,
so lay that one to sleep, would you?
Is she there, or should I just...
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
Well, I think this is so important. You know, we've been sold a bill of goods that has just, that has been... It is completely untrue. And it's part of this, if you don't want to have fat on your body, don't put fat into your body.
Yeah.
Concept, which has no scientific basis at all. It's an emperor without clothing. You know, think about how, farmers for centuries have known that if you want to fatten an animal, or if you're a French farmer, and this is, you know, the ethics of this is debatable, but if you're trying to make pâté de foie gras, which means fatty goose liver, you know, you're trying to create geese with fatty liver because the French and some others think that that's really delicious to eat. Well, you don't feed them fat. They know you feed it processed carbohydrates. You feed them grains. And you don't even have to feed sugar. You just feed, you know, grain, and you force feed it. And so the grains rapidly turn into sugar. That sugar goes right into the liver, and insulin levels further program the liver for fat storage. There's it's very clear now that a higher fat, lower carbohydrate diet is about the fastest way to drain the liver of its excess of fat. I post on this. I've just posted several articles on this on my social media. I invite your listeners to follow me. I'm at David Ludwig MD on Facebook and on Twitter. And this has just been a completely opposite of the truth. These high carbohydrate diets, low fat, high carbohydrate diets are actually very good ways to produce fatty liver.
Yeah, and that's why we're seeing so much. I want to get to Dr. Paul-Ann Balch on line two, who has a long history and is a good friend of mine and has run the obesity clinic at Kaiser Permanente. Paul-Ann, you're on.
Hi, Chris. Hi, David. Hi. So nice to meet you. You know, when Chris told me you weren't going to be on your show today, I went through my Kindle list of about 30 different diet books that she and I have talked about over the years and really loved yours.
I guess that makes me 31.
But 31, right.
So one for all the classic flavors at Baskin and Robbins.
Right. So I'm a family physician. I've been in practice for about 20 years. And the classic presentation is the postmenopausal woman who has been on every diet, somewhat like the previous caller, who is just frustrated and in tears. And I am intrigued with the possibility of offering them your program mixed with intermittent fasting. In my own history, I have 5 diabetics in my family. And I think the problem of insulin resistance, when you realize all foods raise insulin to some degree, that the prospect of maybe tuning them with your induction and then offering them the opportunity to integrate fasting into their routine does offer some potential for freedom from food, which many chronic dieters would love, without some of the deprivation that you've mentioned. Could you address that, how we can help some of these deserving people get their 17-year-old metabolism back?
Sure. Well, yeah, I don't know if we'll get quite to 17, but, I'm realizing as I look in the mirror that I'm probably not going to get my 17-year-old head of hair back. but, you know, we want to age, and actually I'll be speaking in December at the Anti-Aging Conference in Las Vegas, giving one of the keynotes, and it's really not about stopping aging. We just want to age. Mm-hmm. I won't use the word gracefully. That's got the wrong impression. We want to age well. So we want that clock to be turning slowly, and we want our natural genetic repair mechanisms to be operating as effectively as possible. Now, I agree with what you said, that first of all, It may take many different approaches to, after a lifetime of metabolic hits, to really turn things around. And, you know, I'm not proposing that one diet, you know, my diet book or any diet book is going to work by itself for everybody. And there's a lot of individual variation between people. In fact, that principle is taken into account in phase 3 of my program, where we let people through checklists and symptom trackers, begin to craft an individualized program that's right for them, both for their biology as well as for their culture and their food preferences and all. But even after, let me make one more point, and then I'll more directly address what you said. There are many different contributors to metabolic stress. Diet is a big one, but sleep deprivation, an excessive sedentary lifestyle, maybe these endocrine disruptors that we're exposed to in our food, in our air, in our water. So this program is designed to address one of the key contributors, which is foods that raise our insulin level too much. But once we've taken care of that, we may need to address other things. Are our hormones, is our thyroid working properly, again, these lifestyle issues of sleep and stress, which certainly are chronic issues for me. But then perhaps for some people, because of a lifetime of metabolic stress, they do need to take another step into intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. You want to go into that with the basics already covered. If you, it's like mm-hmm. trying to jump into advanced calculus without knowing, you know, arithmetic. It's not just not going to work. It could cause harm. You know, it could cause mm-hmm. intense frustration for people. And we don't want people who failed diets for so long to just, you know, suffer and fail another one. I think they can work well together.
I think in my practice, so many people have been kind of coerced into an obsession with eat this, don't eat that, don't eat what. The prospect of actually a 24-hour period that they might work into their lives where they don't eat at all, and seeing that, hey, I didn't drop over because I was metabolically prepared by a program such as yours, it gives people a sense of freedom. And I think it mimics more our primitive history, where there were cycles where food was available and less available. And as Dr. Fong suggests in his work, perhaps the norepinephrine release from long periods of hunger was adaptive to going out and finally finding food.
Yeah.
I'm excited by the possibility of the two, and I think the program that you suggested is more consistent with pre-processed era food availability than most people have experienced. So I think it's exciting, the potential to integrate the two possibilities for many of our patients and our customers.
Great.
All right. Thanks, Pauline. That's really helpful. Those of us who are not only in the field, but, you know, have experienced the issue ourselves. David, did you ever have any issues with your own weight?
Well, when I was younger, you know, I was lean and fit, very athletic just by nature, and that had really become part of my self-identity. And then, like so many people beginning in my 20s and 30s, I was adding about a pound or two a year, so that when I reached mid-90s, just as I was finishing my endocrinology training and beginning to get into research on weight control, and at the time I was doing basic laboratory studies on rodents and genes. But by that point, I had just about to cross the tipping point from normal weight body mass index into an overweight one, which is the cutoff is 25, and was having a bit of an identity crisis. Here I'm,
yes.
You know, being an obesity researcher and myself. I remember my waist had gone from 30 when I was 18 to 34, and would I have to go to the next size, 35 waist.
Right.
And it was fortunately just at that time that I came across old studies and thinking that really questioned the calorie in, calorie out model, and caused me to undergo a radical change from how I was approaching, you know, my career. I ultimately shifted out of laboratory research into clinical research with people, which is to me much more gratifying and much more immediately relevant to the problem. You know, I don't think, you know, rodent obesity is a huge public health problem these days, you know, and the things that we learn in rodents are not necessarily directly translated to humans.
No.
But I also changed my own eating pattern. I had always eaten more or less healthy, you know, pretty much what the food guide pyramid had recommended, lots of whole grains and fruits and vegetables. But, you know, an afternoon snack would be I remember I'd go to Au Bon Pain in the mall next to Harvard and get an orange scone and a tea in the afternoon, and that would revive me. But then I'd crash again a few hours later and be just starving for dinner. And
yeah.
When I greatly reduced these processed carbs, flooded my diet with healthy fats, and made sure to get enough protein, which does not mean a lot of meat. This is perfectly consistent with the plant-based approach to eating. But that within a few days, it was like a metabolic switch, an unrecognized switch was flipped. I felt, you know, like a miraculous sense of well-being. After eating, I would just feel great, and hunger would stay at bay for hours rather than, you know, experiencing these cravings soon after eating. And without trying to lose weight, About 20 pounds melted off over 4 or 5 months. I went back to a waist size of about 31. I'm kind of more like 32 now. But over those last 20 years, statistically, my weight would have continued to increase by a pound or two a year. Right now, I'm pretty much the same weight as I was when I was 18.
Fantastic. Now, we have this great testimonial, Dominique in St. Paul. She was a participant in your pilot program. So she's going to report in because it's been a year. And this is like divine timing.
Did you find her?
She just called in. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So, Dominique.
I did not arrange that.
No, I know. I know.
So, hello.
Hi, Dominique. So you're on. Give us your experience. Thank Dr. Ludwig for changing your life.
That is absolutely true. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Ludwig. And the Dawn. This program changed my life. It's not a program. It's an awakening, and it's educational, and it gave me my power back. I could go on and on. But it's been over 12 months since I completed the end of the pilot, which was done in May of 2015 for the pilot. And I have continued to lose weight, and it's not about the weight. My prolactin levels have dropped. I have a healthier gut biome. I involuntarily fast because I'm not hungry and I'm satisfied from the intake of fat that I have in my diet. And I'm so grateful to you for coming out against the grain with this program.
Well, thank you. It's so great to hear from you. I don't think we've ever actually met, but we certainly have corresponded, and you were, mm-hmm. I know Dawn was really spoke very affectionately about you. And we have a testimonial by you in the book. Please join our, if you're not in our Facebook group, we have a free, non-commercial Facebook community of over 6,000 people following our program. It's called the official Always Hungry, with a question mark, Always Hungry book community on Facebook. And people give support to each other, new recipes. Dawn and I are working on a follow-up cookbook.
Oh, good.
You know, there are always going to be challenges, as we were talking about with the last question. You know, even with the perfect diet, we live in a society that is full of temptations, full of stress, and we need community support. We need community support to stay on track, and then ultimately we have to work together to make the world a less toxic place, where the healthful choice is the easy and convenient choice, and also ultimately the inexpensive choice. And so that's what our community is about. So please, we'd love to see you there if you're not already a member.
Excellent.
Dominique, can you tell us how much weight you lost and, where you were and where you are now?
Oh, at the end of the pilot, I was going between 20 and 30 pounds. I actually lost more inches than I did weight, which kind of supports the fact that, you do retain muscle. The fat kind of goes away and the muscle stays. I'm actually down... I'm down 45 total. I fit into a size 8 wedding dress, which I never in a million years thought I would be able to do. And I have energy. I feel good. I don't have brain fog. And what's interesting is when you're on your own, or what they call phase 3, you don't think of it like, oh, I screwed up. You don't think of it like a diet. If you follow it, it's just the way you eat. And you can have cake, and your body is in a better position to burn off that sugar than you were before you reset. And that's the little helper along the way. And I've had to convert so many people along the way. I couldn't even tell you how many naysayers. I'm like, wow, you shouldn't be having that. Why are you drinking that? Why you got whole cream in your coffee? Because it's good, and that helps me eat a more balanced breakfast, and I'm full through lunch where I have a light snack, and it's just, like I said, I struggled with my prolactin levels. I had seen an endocrinologist. Nobody could figure it out. And that was just a side bonus for me, that those went into the normal level.
Oh, I love that. Dr. Ludwig, do you have anything to say about that? I happened to be at Tufts when they came up with the prolactin assay. And the next thing you know, we had all these patients getting transsphenoidal hypophysectomies, which because we didn't know the natural history of the pituitary adenomas. And now we know that most of them just go away on their own. But we had all these women now leaking cerebrospinal fluid through their nose because they had discovered a test. So now we got to go get it with a knife. Do you know any studies that show that when it makes sense to me, by the way, Dominic, that when you balance all the hormones in the body, starting with insulin, which is kind of a master hormone, everything else would get better as well. But I'm just interested, Dr. Ludwig, if you know of anything in that realm.
Yeah, I'm interested, too, as to why that happened.
Well, I don't have any specific data on prolactin itself, but let's just step back for a moment. The basic concept here is that, you know, we don't want to impose a restriction on the body by eating less and forcing the physical activity is good, but we don't want to just eat less and move more, which tries to force calories out of the body. But if the fat cells are continuing to be on calorie storage overdrive, you're actually sucking, you're actually depriving the organs that you need to keep well fed, which is the brain and the muscle and you know, the other, you know, critical organs. So we treat the problem there, which helps the fat cells open up. Then the brain, for some time, for some people, for the first time in decades, experiences a consistent, steady fuel supply. It calms down. It lowers stress hormones. And it then revs up metabolism. The other thing that happens with this, in addition to insulin lowering, is chronic inflammation lowers. Those are the two key, we call them, you know, the twin metabolic troublemakers: high insulin, insulin resistance, and chronic inflammation. Yeah. So when you improve chronic inflammation, all sorts of wonderful things can begin to happen in the body involving hormones, you know, stabilizing themselves, the organs that make these hormones, the glands, may function more properly. We know that inflammation in a gland can cause dysfunction. So it stands to reason that things could get better. In our Facebook group, we have lots of people reporting that before they've lost weight, their first experience, and this was mine as well, was improved sense of well-being. Chronic inflammation, when that subsides, you just feel better. And so I'm delighted to hear these stories. Is it a proven effect? No, but I'm not surprised.
Right. Beautiful. Well, Dominique, thank you so much. So are you getting married soon? You mentioned a wedding dress.
I am. I'm getting married this April. Well, April 2017.
Oh, that must have been so much fun to go in and try on wedding dresses as a size 8.
I couldn't. It was a trick. I had to make her show me that I did not believe it. But, you know, honestly, I would trade just to feel the way I feel and to have control. The weight is a bonus. It's just
beautiful.
Feeling better.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. So just for station identification, everyone, my guest today, in case you tuned in late, is Dr. David Ludwig of Harvard Children's Hospital, Boston Children's Hospital. His book is Always Hungry: Conquer Cravings, Retrain Your Fat Cells, Lose Weight Permanently. And his website is drdavidludwig.com. And also, for those who are, we all need community support. And so you have a Facebook page for this. It's the official Facebook page is Official Always Hungry Facebook page. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, on Facebook. Official Always Hungry ? Book Community. Free and non-commercial. It's a private group, but, you know, request membership and we'll take you right in. And then hopefully we can support, you know, Dawn, my wife, who did the recipes and meal plans, actively supports, you know, I'm actively there, and we're all trying to support each other in this critical journey of personal health recovery. And then ultimately working together to help make our social environment a healthier place to live.
Right. Now, I want to ask you about that because you are politically active, and bless you. When I think it was JAMA came out with those documents that the sugar industry had been influencing the scientific community starting in the 70s, in the halls of academia, and you and I both know that the wheels of medicine turn very, very slowly. I've been told that the time it takes for something that's really helpful and not harmful to get into common practice is about 17 years. What are you seeing in the field when you walk around the hospital with your colleagues? Tell us what's happening that you can see as a change.
Well, I think in 17 years, we've gone from what was a dominant, domineering paradigm that if you don't want fat on your body, don't eat fat. Just, you know, cut back. I wrote a recent commentary for JAMA and also an op-ed for CNN, pointing out how just, you know, 17 years ago or so, people were recommending sugar. Some of these folks were the leaders of the field of nutrition and in the government, recommending sugar as a good way to literally, quote, dilute fat calories. The idea was that there's the sugar-fat seesaw. So sugar, you know, all carbohydrates were thought to be at worst benign. And now, where are we? Well, no self-respecting nutritionist that's not associated with the industry is making that statement now. People are widely beginning to see that just because sugar has fewer calories per gram than fat, doesn't mean that it's healthy, that we have to begin thinking about food based on its metabolic and hormonal effects. That's a sea change. And the purpose of writing my book was to help that paradigm shift along. And the fundamental premise of our book is that calories are an interesting scientific concept. It's irrelevant to weight control, just as measures of body heat are irrelevant to how we control temperature. If we get the inputs right, the body controls its temperature, its respiratory rate, and a whole set of other functions perfectly well. The same is true for body weight, although the time frame for that is a little longer than the time frame for temperature control.
Yeah. Have you found that this kind of approach, so you're with children, so tell me what happens when a family brings in a child, and perhaps, and we've all seen this, where one child is markedly heavier than the other children. How do you approach this without singling out the child as the identified patient? And obviously, you got to get the whole family on board. So how do you do that?
Yeah, let me just emphasize that this, you know, our book is written for adults primarily. The Always Hungry, the program that I founded, the Optimal Weight for Life program, is a family-based program, you know, with an emphasis on children.
A minute and a half left, so I want.
Yes, of course we don't. There are genetic factors that differ even within a family, where one kid is susceptible and another kid might not be at that moment. Although most kids are going to suffer with a weight problem at some point in their life, just given the prevalence of obesity. So we work together as a family. If everybody works together, nobody gets stigmatized, and the lean twin gets, the lean sibling gets protected against future problems. The parents with high cholesterol or high blood pressure themselves get benefits.
That is beautiful. Now, if someone wanted to know about the program for children and they don't live in Boston and they can't come over there to Boston Children's Hospital, can they learn about this at drdavidludwig.com?
Yes, come to my website, doctor, as in dr, davidludwig.com. Follow me on social media, David Ludwig, MD. And, we're all trying to work together to raise consciousness. We all have to, we're all in this together. And this is a question of the survival of our country. I mean, we don't want to bankrupt our economy with chronic disease healthcare costs, let alone the human suffering of these preventable diet-related diseases.
Exactly. Dr. Ludwig, thank you so much. I think we've helped a lot of people today, including me. So, Dr. David Ludwig, everyone, always hungry. Go get the book, sign up for his social media as well.